Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spider. So last week we talked a bit about what to do and how to plan for just in case you are incapacitated and can't care for your tarantulas. It could be, you know, a vacation, you get stranded somewhere. It could be, you know, hopefully not, but some type of hospitalization. You're sick, you hurt yourself. Again, we talked about the fact that I hurt my shoulder. I have a bum shoulder that, my God, if that ever goes out, I'm going to have some trouble getting some of the ones on the top shelves. But just kind of planning and brainstorming and coming up with some type of plan ahead of time, making sure that your collection's labeled, making sure that, you know, if something like this should happen, you're not caught in a terrible situation that's made even worse and compounded by the fact that you're not able to care for your tarantulas, which is going to add even more stress. However, when I did this one, I had a funny feeling this was going to happen. Some people immediately thought that it was going to be about what to do if there's an emergency like what just recently happened in Texas. And my heart goes out to all, I've talked to several hobbyists in Texas who had their collections decimated by the power outages and the cold temperatures. I mean, it was horrific to hear some of the stories and some of the things people lost because of it. And I think some people had that in the back of their mind and thought, all right, this is going to be one on what to do in one of those types of situations. And I kind of covered this before. It's one of those topics that's difficult because the best option is an expensive option. So we will go through a couple things you could do. We will go through what happened to Billy and I a couple times in the past. Now, in our old house, we live on a hill that has exposed power lines and trees all up the hill, and they're old trees. The majority of them are dying. They're a hazard, quite frankly. And every time we have a major storm or the wind blows, you know, over 10 miles per hour, we seem to have a power outage. Now, normally they get them fixed rather quickly, but we have had a couple instances when we were there when it took quite a while, 2, 3, even I think one time 4 days for them to come and fix the power. Luckily, the majority of the longer power outages happened either in the summer or in the, you know, springtime where it's a little cooler at night, but we could deal with it. But the biggest issue is we lived in constant fear for a while of power outages because of the tarantulas. Now, the tarantulas, we talk about the fact, and this is why the ideal temperature thing drives me nuts. We talk about that they can do well at room temperature. Well, the majority of species can dip well below what we would consider room temperature for shorter periods of time and be okay. So, for example, there are species out there that are exposed to cooler temps where it gets in the 50s, the 40s. Now, the majority of them will burrow to get away from the cold weather. So, if you have a place where it freezes, you can bet that the tarantula has burrowed to the point where it's under the freeze mark in the ground, the line where the soil is frozen. They get down deep enough that they are safer there from the extreme cold weather, but know that they can be exposed to cooler temps and be out and about in the cooler temps. So one thing right off the bat is to not always panic if the temperatures, and I've done it, so I'm not judging anybody or that's had this issue before, but when the power goes out, I watch that thermometer obsessively, and I watch it dip, you know, 68, 67, 65, 60, and you start to freak out because you're used to keeping them a little bit warmer. Again, they do appreciate some warmth. They grow faster when they're warm, but they can do those shorter periods of time without warmth. So that's something to keep in mind. But we had a situation a while back where the power went out. It was a freezing, freezing cold night, and the temperatures in the house soon dropped to the point where, like, everybody was cold. It wasn't just a spider issue. It was, what are we going to do with the kids? How are we going to, you know, stay the night here and not be freezing? You don't want to have, we can't really get a hotel because we had 4 dogs. You know, we don't want to leave the spiders behind, so we kind of hunker down. But one thing you can do, and I'll go through a couple possibilities, two of which I've done, one of which was recommended to me by somebody who had done it themselves, and it sounded like a really good idea, so I'll share it. And if that's you, please leave a comment on Facebook or drop me an email so I can give you proper credit, because I thought it was a really good idea. But if you have a smaller collection, I've spoken to some people that have just, you know, right now they have maybe an adult or so and a couple slings, or, you know, under 10 and in smaller enclosures. One thing that I've heard that people have done, and I thought this was a neat idea, is that they took a cooler, like a big, they kept a big cooler. It was originally as a beer cooler, something, bring one of the big styrofoam ones. And what they would do is they ventilated it a bit and they used heat packs, the same types you would ship in. And they built like a little, for lack of a better term, like a little makeshift furnace inside of it, where they put some heat packs in something. They protected it from the rest of the spiders. They didn't pack the spiders right up against the heat packs. They put them in, I believe it was like a little box with some holes in it so that it would radiate off. I forget, the guy described it to me. I thought it was the coolest idea ever. And then put some space in between and then laid his tarantulas down the other end. I believe at one point he had it was a larger, it was like a, maybe a T. albopilosis or something, an adult. He took the adult out and put it in a smaller enclosure so it would fit in there, and then took all his little slings and put it in there and put a thermostat in it so he could make sure it didn't get too hot, closed the thing up, and he said it had no problem keeping the temperature up there in the high 60s, even 70 or so, which kept them warm while they were experiencing the power outage. And I thought that was pretty brilliant. Now, he had the foresight because, again, we had compared notes. He lived in an area as well that they ended up getting a lot of power outages. So in his case, he was thinking ahead and kind of before the situation, before the power went out, he went out, found the coolers. It might have been more than one. I forget what it was. It was a big styrofoam cooler, though. He found a couple of those. He built this thing up. He tried it a couple times to make sure it worked, and then he just kept it there in case. So he had the whole thing set up so that in case the power went out, all was a matter of is opening up those heat packs, activating them. Obviously, it takes a little while from the get-going, so keep that in mind. But he'd activate the heat packs, put all his spiders in, close the top. By the time the heat packs had activated, you know, it already dropped, the temperature had already dropped in his house, so it kind of countered that, and it worked great. So I thought that was a really neat idea, but again, that would take some planning, and you could probably do it without using a styrofoam cooler. I'm thinking that if you had a big tank, like a big glass tank, you could line it with some styrofoam insulation and do something similar. There are some creative things you could do in large areas. I'm guessing that if you had a large cabinet, again, you'd want it ventilated. You want to make sure there was a little bit of airflow in there. But there are things you could do to set up to make something makeshift that would allow you to put the majority of your collection or even your slings. The slings are going to be the ones that are likely to be more negatively impacted by the power outage in the cold temps. So even if the larger specimens may be okay if it dips down in 50s and 40s for just a little bit of time, obviously that's not ideal. But the slings especially, I know when the power would go out at my other house, it was always the slings I was really worried about. So you could even do something that just holds the slings. You could get creative with it. It would be, for people that have the do-it-yourselfer in them, it would be a neat way to kind of put something together so that you have that safety net should the power go out. And I think it would probably be a cheaper alternative compared to the one that Billy and I settled on, which we'll go over in a moment. So that would be something I would consider. If I had a situation like, well, right now with the amount of animals I have, that wouldn't work. And that's what Billy and I ran into when it first started happening. I had a smaller collection. It was easier to do. And I'll tell you what we did in a minute. Once the collection got to a certain size, it was kind of impractical to try anything that would involve me taking all those tarantulas and putting them into a warmer environment, you know, a smaller enclosure or whatever. So that would be one. Again, I did not do this. It was not my idea. I did when I was talking to him kind of, I want to say he sent me pictures, but I don't know if he ever actually sent the pictures. But I think there's definitely a way you could do it that involved, you know, again, you wouldn't have to use just the styrofoam. I think that's what he used, but there's a different, you could use different coolers. You could use cabinets. There's a lot of different ways. So if anybody's ever tried this, please chime in. Or if anybody gives it a try, let us know what you come up with. Again, it's going to cost you a little bit of money for the actual vessel, whatever you're going to put them in. It's going to cost you some money for the heat packs. Although if you buy them in bulk, you can get them rather cheap. And then you're safe. If something goes down, at least for a little while, you're covered. But again, this would only cover people with smaller collections or maybe people just making sure that their slings have the heat that they need, that they don't lose a bunch of slings because it gets too cold. Now, if you have too many to do that, another trick, and this is what Billy and I ended up doing a couple times when the power went out, is we bought one of those indoor kerosene heaters, the kind of cylindrical ones that you obviously fill with kerosene, and they give a good amount of heat off. And this was, we needed this because the house was so cold. One of the times that everybody sleeping in the house was cold. And again, you want to be careful with fumes and everything. I kind of kept the little window cracked open just a bit to let, you know, some of the food, because it does create a smell. And I don't know if I would put this directly in the room with the tarantulas if it's a closed room. But what we did was, the tarantula room was off the dining room. And we put this, we kind of put it in a place where it was almost in the doorway of the two. So the heat was kind of going into the tarantula room. It was also heating the dining room and some of the living room. It worked really well. It didn't get really fumy because I was really worried. There is a little bit of an odor and I was worried about, you know, the tarantulas with that. But it was kind of, all right, they're going to freeze or we're going to take the chance of, you know, the exhaust from this heater doing some damage. So we kind of, again, negotiated in a place where it wasn't directly. I would not close it and close it in a small room with the tarantulas. I would do something that it's getting some supplementary heat from wherever you put it. And it did a great job. I mean, it kept the temperatures. I believe the temperature didn't dip below 60, which was much better than it would have been because it was already dipping down into the 40s at one point. So it kept it warm enough that they were fine. And we ended up running it for, I think, two nights. I think the power went on the second night and that worked really well. So I don't know. I think the heaters overall, usually under $150, $130, $120, depends on how much you want to spend, but that's a pretty good trade-off to know that you have that there. Again, you want to have the kerosene on hand. I would recommend trying it out. All this stuff, I think a lot of it is making sure you're prepared so it's not such a panic when something goes down, and knowing where to set it up, how to do it, that's important. Because I know the first time we got this thing, it was like brand new, and it was like the mad scramble to try to get it running, and I'd never used one before. It added a little bit of stress to the situation. So, if you do go this route, definitely do a trial run, see how it works, see where you could put it. If your tarantulas are in like a bedroom or a living room or a bigger, a larger room, that's perfect. You can just drop it right there. But the problem was my tarantula room, it was a small room, so that heater would have been right in the middle. It would have been kind of a fire hazard where there was a lot of stuff around it, and it would have been, I think, too much heat for that small area. But if you're in a bigger room, obviously it's going to work great. You can adjust the amount of heat that comes out of it. But I mean, for 100, probably if you went and bought a couple gallons of kerosene in that, you're probably talking under $150, and that's for many of us less than the cost of some of the more expensive slings. So that would be another thing that for people with larger collections, that's a cheaper route, a less expensive route for you to use for a backup if your power should go out and you're left in the cold with your tarantula collection. And we did use this. We didn't have any deaths. We didn't have any issues afterwards. So I did have success with it. It kept them. And at one point, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think it might've been my scorpions were the Emperor scorpions. She was gravid, and I was really worried that she was going to lose them because it was getting cold, and she did fine. So obviously it was enough to keep a gravid scorpion alive, and the babies came out great. So it worked great in that respect. So that would be something that I would consider checking out for folks. And again, it can be tough because I think with the Texas thing, from speaking to some of the people in Texas, that's not something you're accustomed to having happen. You're not used to power outages and huge cold snaps. So I don't think a lot of people would have ever thought in a million years that's something they would have to plan for. I know we started thinking about this stuff because as soon as I got heavy into the hobby, we did have, we're in New England. We get bad weather. We have power outages. We have power outages in the summer. We have power outages in hurricane season. We have power outages in the winter. And we seem to have even more of them up on the hill where I used to live than a lot of the places. So it was a necessity that we started thinking immediately about what are we going to do if the power goes out. For folks that don't have these situations, it might not even cross your mind. So it might be something you start thinking of now, just in case. I'm going to put a little money aside and I'm going to pick up a kerosene heater and have it there. And we're going to run it, even if you're in a warmer area, it just might be something enough to give you that peace of mind that if the power goes out, that's one less thing you have to worry about. Now, for folks who have really large collections or don't want to bother with the kerosene heaters and want to invest a little bit of money, and this is how I saw it. So again, this is going to be the most expensive alternative, but personally, I think it's the best alternative. What we finally did is we went out and got hooked up for a portable generator. It's pricey. You should be able, you're talking probably $1,500, $2,000, which is a huge chunk of money. Obviously, not everybody's sitting around on $2,000, especially these days. But at that point, we had saved some money up. And I think a generator you can usually get, I think it cost us, if I remember correctly, it was about $800 to get the system hooked up to our house. And I think one of the reasons was a breaker box was different than it was an older breaker box or something, and they couldn't find the piece to do the whatever it was a piece they needed that cost a little bit more, and they had to get custom ordered. But it was about, I think, $800 to $900 to get the receptacle hooked up on the outside of the house, get it hooked up the fuse box, get the safety switches put on, which was a darn good deal. And then we went and bought from Amazon, I think the first generator we had was around $700. Now, you don't need to get a generator that big. We got a larger one because we started looking at it, and we're like, we're going to want to be able to run, the TVs and stuff like that. So we got a bigger generator, but figure out what load you're going to need for your house and pick up a generator accordingly. We saw some for sale that were like $300 that would run a small house or at least keep your heat running. So figure out what you need. If that's the case, you could probably get in under $1,200. I don't know, people out there that do this kind of stuff, feel free to chime in on what it would normally cost you. But I think on off of the generator and to get it hooked up to our house, it was about $1,600, I want to say. Which again, not chump change at all. But might I point out, if you're somebody that has a huge collection, you probably have well over $1,600 invested in your collection. I know for a fact, I talk to people that spend, $1,000 to $1,500 on tarantulas a pop, just buying a bunch of them. So the idea would be you're going to get a few less tarantulas, but you're going to have the peace of mind knowing that if your power goes out, you have a backup generator to keep the heat on. So that would be for people who have a much larger collection that have the means, that would be the thing I would encourage you. And again, I understand it's extra money. I understand it's a bit more expensive. But I'll tell you, the peace of mind, the first time we lost power with that generator, and it was just a matter of dragging the thing out, revving it up, plugging it up to the house, and we were good to go, and I didn't have to worry about my spiders, that was worth the money right there. And we did have to scrimp a little bit to pick it up at the time, but my God, it was such a great purchase. So that would be something I would look into. And again, find a good electrician. It may be cheaper. Some people may be actually in houses. I know the house that I just bought already has a hookup for it. The one we had, it's kind of stunk because our old house, they originally had the hookup for it, and apparently whoever was there ripped it out for some reason. Like, they, when we bought the house, they're like, oh yeah, then they have the hookup for the generator. Well, no, they didn't. They had ripped the thing out. It wasn't working. It was disconnected, so we had to get it all hooked up. So if you have it already hooked up, it's perfect. Just buy a generator. Look for something, go on. There's charts. You can find what your, you know, max load you can hold on it. So figure out what you want to continue to run. For people that just want to run your heat and maybe your well pump or whatever, you can get a smaller one. For people that want some more things, like we got one that we could run the TV and stuff because we have the kids in the house. They're going to want to go and do something, play games or whatever. We got a bigger one so that we'd have the capability of running more things. But figure out what you need. You can get a bare minimum one and probably, I'm guessing, get in under a grand with the whole setup. But that would be my answer. And I had again, the only reason I'm going into this is I had a couple people go, yeah, I really thought you were going to go into ways to protect your collection should the heat go out because of what went on. And I realized afterwards, like, yeah, the headline or the title I chose for it really, especially with what had just happened, sounded like that's where it was going. So those would be my three top suggestions. I do invite anybody that's had other, you know, that's experienced power outages in cold weather to come forward and tell me what did you do for that situation. I do think there are limited options, especially for larger collections. I mean, that's the problem we ran into when we were looking at it. Even here, it was like imperative that we made sure that we had a backup generator should things go down here, because I obviously need to keep my tarantula room warm. I have a huge room up here and I can't afford to have it go cold for long periods of time. So having, just knowing that you've thought about this ahead of time. So now we've covered basically two major types of emergency. One, you're not able to take care of your collection. What are you going to do? And two, power outage during the wintertime or during cold weather. What do you do about it? Those would be my suggestions. Now, again, if anybody else out there has something else they've done or something, please feel free and come forward, because I think the best thing is when people share information, because honestly, I can only report on things that I have actually experienced myself. In this case, that's what we did. My collection was too big for the little incubator thing, so we did the kerosene space heater, and that worked out great. But feel free, if somebody else has got something else, another option, another alternative, feel free to chime in and let people know about it. Now, for the next topic today, this one I've covered and alluded to before, but I think it bears repeating, and I don't know if I've gone into it into depth, but we'll start it off like this. A few years ago, I made a discovery with some P. muticus juveniles that I got. I basically got some juveniles from Tom Patterson, and the big thing back then was when the P. muticus were known to have 9-foot-long burrows in the wild. So the general consensus was that when you tried to set up a P. muticus, the idea was, obviously you're not going to give them 9 feet a burrow, but to give them as much dirt to dig in as possible. So when I got mine, what I did was I set them up into these large Sterilite containers that had about, I don't know, about 8.5-9 inches of substrate in them. I did a little cork bark hide with a starter burrow underneath. I put them in it. At the time, they were around probably 2 inches or so. And both of them immediately dug all the way down to the bottom, dug these huge, their tunnels basically went all the way around, completely encircling the entire bottom of the enclosure. They had a couple entrances and exits at one point. It was crazy. And I fed them a couple times, they ate, and then I noticed both of them filled in their holes, and that was it. And I didn't see them for a while. So I'm like, all right, this is normal. It's a fossorial species. They're not hungry at the moment. Whatever, we'll move on and we'll wait till, you know, they come out and I'll feed them again. So I waited. And basically what I was waiting for is those burrows to open back up. Well, a long time went by, months went by, and I was filling the water dishes. I was pouring a little water down the side, because although this is one of these species where they talk about they're an arid species, they do burrow deep into the ground where they do find moist substrate. So I found that mine do prefer some moist substrate, even as, you know, especially as slings and even as juveniles. And to make a very long story short, I started freaking out because one day I took a flashlight and I shined it in to one of the enclosures, and I could just make out the spider, and it looked like it was very thin. This wasn't a spider that was in pre-molt. They had either molted or had just been kind of wasting away in the bottom. So I kind of freaked out a bit, and I did something that you're never supposed to do and that we always tell people not to do. I took the back of a paintbrush. I basically soaked down a corner where I saw that the burrow had originally been, soaked it down so it'd pack a little bit better, and then used the back of a paintbrush to open up a hole that went all the way down into the burrow. And then what I did was I took a cricket, a live cricket, and we'll get into this a little further down the line, but I wouldn't do this again this way, but it did work out. Took a live cricket, I dropped it into the burrow, it ran over, it might have been a cricket or roach, and it ran over around I watched it run right around the thing to where the spider was. The spider pounced on it, took it down immediately, and started eating. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is not what I was led to believe would happen with these, you know, with the fossorial species. You're told to never dig them up. They will come up if they're smart enough to come up when they need food. And here's a situation where this thing had been down there for months, had been very, very skinny, and was obviously ravenously hungry. So I dropped another one down, and it grabbed that one. And so I took the other one out, and I couldn't quite see it, but I opened up the burrow, I took the chance, and this time I did wound the cricket beforehand, dropped it into the hole, it bounced around a little bit, and all of a sudden, boom, spider comes bolting up, grabs it. So that was two spiders that were down about probably 9 inches, 8.5, 9 inches or so, had been down there for months, weren't eating, weren't surfacing, weren't opening up their burrows to eat, yet they were starving. So it got me thinking, and that I did a video on it, and I put it out, and at that time, I had fully expected to get torn to shreds, because you know how it is in the tarantula hobby when you do something that goes against what people have thought for years to be true. True, especially that. And I do get why, and flat out, I want to make this very, very clear. I am not, the point of this part of the podcast is not to freak people out into digging up their spiders. I don't think that is the norm. I don't think it's something that happens often. And I do think it is preventable. So when I put that video up, I expected to get jumped on it. What ended up happening is a lot of people came forward with similar stories with the Pimutacus, with their slings especially. It's usually smaller specimens because I think with the larger specimens, they get to the point where they're so big, you can't really, there's not many enclosures out there that would allow you to give them enough substrate to have them get lost in it. But it happens a lot. I had a lot of people come forward and say it happened to their slings and juveniles. I had experienced it before with slings where I put the slings. I got these two little, feel terribly about it. They were about probably 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch, very small slings. And I put them in 32-ounce deli cups, which probably had about, 5.5 inches of substrate that was moist on the bottom, drier on the top. They dug all the way down to the bottom. I would drop crickets in. I would drop roaches in. They would never come up to hunt, and I lost them because of that. And they basically starved to death because I was under the assumption, and that was what I had been taught, that was a correct setup for them. You give them as much substrate as they want. Well, what people started discussing is that if they have 9-foot burrows, and even if the little slings have large burrows, they likely in the wild stay under because they're in very inhospitable conditions where they live. If they come up on the surface, it's going to be hot, it's going to be dry. There's obviously a threat of predation. What a lot of us have kind of come to the conclusion of is that for some of these species, they're able to find prey under the ground. Maybe bugs go into the burrows and wander in. More likely, they run into grubs and earthworms. There's even apparently crickets that are subterranean crickets that will burrow under the ground where these guys come from. So there's a very good chance that in the wild, they don't have to surface all the time. They dig down far enough, they don't have to come up for a while. They can live and sustain themselves on the prey that's already in the dirt, which is probably why they have these long burrows, because you keep digging, you're going to keep finding prey. That's the thought process. I can't prove that. There's been no research done on it. So for the people that are going to jump in and go, well, you have no proof of that, you're just making, again, it's speculation, but it does make a lot of sense. Now, fast forward, that video has been up for a while, and I've had other people come to me with similar stories involving other species of spiders. And some of them aren't necessarily your fossorial species. They're ones that are a little fossorial as slings, but they came up with similar instances where they had a spider, they had set it up. A lot of times it's in the 32-ounce deli cups, which used to be the standard. I'm guilty of this myself. You'd say, what do you keep them in? All right, well, if it's a fossorial species, give them a 32-ounce deli cup with plenty of substrate. They put them in one of those enclosures, and the spider would dig all the way down to the bottom. In some cases, they would see the spider molted, yet the spider wouldn't come back up to eat. And they'd start freaking out. And they're like, well, everybody says you're not supposed to dig them up. And again, normally you're not. But what do you do? So I've had other people, Ace Amani was one of them. I had somebody with a G. pulchra that had the same issue. There's been a lot of different species. Usually it's the fossorial ones, but again, there's two right there that aren't necessarily considered to be fossorial, although the Ace Amani as adults can still dig. But not ones you'd normally think of or would immediately come to mind when thinking of spiders that might dig themselves down so far that they won't come up. So here is my interpretation of it. And I want people to pay attention and not get the wrong message from this. This is not me telling you to dig up your spiders. This is me telling you to use a little more caution when setting them up. I no longer put tiny arboreal or tiny fossil real species in large, deep 32-ounce deli cups. If I have really tiny fossil real species, I use very small, more shallow, like an inch and a half or so, dram vials, because, again, I don't want a situation where the spider digs down and can't find the prey. And it can happen more often than you think. It's not common, but again, I think a lot of us, we read these, this is what happened to me, the P. muticus. I did my research. Everybody said, give them as much substrate as you did. I was following good research, good husbandry practices, and I ran into those issues. There are people out there that follow good husbandry practices where they read, hey, 32-ounce deli cups, it's like the industry standard for fossorial slings or arboreal slings. You just put a bunch of dirt in there, they're all set. But what ends up happening is we put in, instead of just maybe, you know, 2 or 3 inches of dirt, we fill that thing all the way up. We put a little hole in there. Those guys go all the way down the bottom and they get lost. So I've had people ask me, have I ever had this happen again with other species? And I can actually say, yes, I have. I've had it happen on 4 different occasions that I can, before I did this podcast, I was literally walking around the tarantula room because I'm pretty sure there was one more it happened with, but I can't for the life of me remember which one it is. But right off the top of my head, it happened with a G. pulcher that I had, a sling that I gave it about 4 inches. I put it in a newer enclosure. I wanted to get it out of the sling enclosure. It was in the dram vial. And the enclosure was a little deep. It was about a 16-ounce size, but this sling was very tiny at the time. And I basically put in maybe 3, 3.5 inches of substrate. It had a little burrow. It was eating fine. It went down to the bottom. It was you could tell it was in pre-molt. It was quite fat. It was, you know, doing all the pre-molt things. And then what happened is it molted, and I'm like, all right, it's going to be coming up to eat pretty soon. Well, it didn't come up to eat, and it sat in that little spot. I could see it. Luckily, it was a clear kind of acrylic cylindrical enclosure. I could see it clear as day. It just sat there, and it wasn't eating. It wasn't surfacing, so a week went by. All right, most slings will start eating within a week or so, but some of the species will take a little longer than others. Always depends on the spider. So I waited it out. 2 weeks go by. Getting a little weird, but all right. It ended up being a month, and that thing hadn't eaten. And I'm like, something's not right here. Either it's not well, the molt didn't go right, or it's just not surfacing up. So I was dropping this whole time. I would drop prey items on the top so they'd scamper around. Hopefully it would hear it and come up and get them. It wouldn't come up and get them. I tried crickets. I tried roaches. Finally, again, I did my little trick where I hosed down the spot where I could see the opening to the burrow used to be. So it was nice and wet, and you could pack it. Used the back of a paintbrush, carefully opened up a little hole, and I took a pre-killed roach and dropped it right in the thing. It walked over the pre-killed roach, immediately grabbed it up, and started eating. So there we go, another situation where that happened. And again, this was my setup was probably the issue because I took a smaller sling and gave it a lot of substrate, and it seemed to just hide down there and not come up. So there's a point where, had I not intervened, I don't know if that spider would have resurfaced again looking for prey. That worries me. So again, I always worry about doing podcasts like these because as soon as I do this, I get a bunch of email from people that are like, I just got my LP and it buried itself and it's been buried for 3 days. Should I worry? No, we're not talking about ones that bury themselves for a few days, even for a couple weeks, but we're talking about the ones that you can tell that they've been down there too long that you start worrying about. And it happens. And sometimes you can't tell because I can remember a P. sosme I had that disappeared for several months during the winter and I was freaking out about it. I was convinced it was dead, but it popped up again in the spring. It was totally fine. It had molted. It's knowing your spiders. And so for folks that are new to the hobby, that are just, you know, getting into keeping some of the slings and you're starting to see the burrowing behavior and such, don't panic. This isn't a panic thing, but it's something to keep in the back of your mind. So as far as other species I've seen it with, Formictopus, Cochleus vorax, I have 2 of them. One of them I rehoused into a larger enclosure and I gave it plenty of room to dig. It seemed to really, these guys are really burrowers, like really intricate burrows. It's pretty impressive for Formictopus species. Well, I gave it one that had about 5 inches of substrate. And again, it dug all the way down to the bottom. It filled up its burrow and the entrance to its burrow, and it just disappeared for a while. So I'm like, all right, pre-molt, no problem. Once again, a couple months go by, I shine the flashlight in there, I'm having a hard time seeing it. Finally, I catch it, its booty is really tiny, and it has not resurfaced to eat. Now, if you've raised Formictopus species, they are ravenous. All of them have been ravenous that I've kept. And this one was ravenous beforehand, but then I rehoused it, and then suddenly it's not eating. So Again, I was very careful this time, but I knew where the burrow was under the cork bark, so I did my little trick. I hosed it down, opened up a little spot, and I put a maimed cricket up there. Came back a couple hours later, maimed cricket was gone. It was down the burrow eating. So another situation where I probably gave it a bit too much substrate to dig in. It got to the bottom. It wasn't surfacing up. And when I opened it up, it was fine. And then it did keep the burrow open at that point. Because what I did was after it was, while it was eating the other thing and while the burrow was still open because it hadn't closed it back up, I dropped another cricket in there. And it kept the burrow open at that point. So it seemed to recognize, all right, it's open now. I can go out and find food there. And there was no problems after that. Even more recently, I have an S. Hoffmanni that I picked up recently from Fear Not, beautiful little juvenile that I put into a large, one of those M Design containers. If you ever watch my videos, you see I use them a lot. They're crystal clear. They have the hinge tops and they're about 7.5 inches deep or so. And I filled it up with probably about 6 inches of substrate, but it's a pretty good size enclosure overall. And when I got the spider, I wasn't sure how big it was. So I could have put it in something smaller, but I'm like, this will be fine. It'll grow into it. Again, we have a situation where it dug and these guys burrow. These guys really burrow. I've been really enjoying watching the behavior of these because almost like the P. muticus, down, went straight down, burrowed, dug a tunnel all the way around the side of the enclosure, then dug an extra entrance or exit that came out in the middle of the enclosure. Then it dug another one that went down. It was really impressive, but did a lot of digging. It ate twice and then filled up all the entrances of its burrow and was sitting down the bottom all the way in a corner, you know, probably 5 or 6 inches beneath the substrate. So I could tell by the look of it, it did not look like a spider that was in premolt. This is, I don't obviously have a lot of experience with this species yet. And some of them that will go into like GBBs are ones that come to mind that a lot of times they'll go into premolt and they don't look all that fat. They don't fatten up like some of the other spiders. So I didn't know if this was one of the cases, but it just didn't look to me like it was in premolt at all. And it didn't look like it was fat enough to be, you know, ready to close itself off and not eat. So I gave it some time. I kept the substrate moist, filled the water disc. I would drop a cricket in, let it run around the top. It wouldn't come up and get the cricket. So once again, you guys probably know where this one's going. I went, opened up the entrance to its burrow, maimed a cricket, dropped it at the top of the burrow, came back later on, it was eating. Dropped in another cricket, it ate again. And so again, another instance where the enclosure is it, and this is where when people talk about, can you give a spider too big, too much room? I hesitate on that one. I have a hard time with that one because one line of thought is like, hey, obviously in the wild, they're in the great big wide world and they do just fine. In the great big wide world, I also think there are a lot more natural prey items around than there are in somebody's collection in a tank. So even if you give them a 20-gallon tank and you put a little tiny spider in there and it digs all the way down to the bottom, in your collection, if that substrate's clean substrate, you're not going to have any bugs for it to eat in there. It's whatever you drop in. And if it happens to find them, great. If the bugs stay in the other end of that container or they run around up top where it's several inches of substrate above the spider and the spider doesn't sense it, it's not going to eat. It's not going to find anything to feast upon. However, in the wild, the big difference is, and when we talk about, you know, big wide world, obviously, oh, there's this huge wide world. They find food there. Yeah, they do, because there's millions of insects around for them to eat. They're in the ground. They're running around the surface. There's a lot more opportunity for them to snag a meal than in a collection where you got a keeper that's throwing a couple things in once a week. So we always need to keep that in the backs of our minds when we make those unfair apples and oranges comparisons to what a spider lives like in a collection and what a spider lives like in the real world. So that's one of the reasons right here, this topic right now about the burying themselves is one of the reasons, again, I encourage people that at least early on, when you have an adult spider, totally different ballgame, you can give them a lot of room. I've seen some beautiful, you know, long aquarium setups with plants and different burrows. And as long as they have a place to hide, they'll move around, they'll find a burrow they like, and they'll use it. It's perfectly fine. For the smaller specimens, I think we need to use some care when we set them up. Be careful when you get a sling to try to make sure that this, the enclosure you got, you want to give it some room to dig, but you don't want to give it so much room that it loses itself. One trick I've started using with some of my slings is that I put a little, like when I get a new one coming in, I know it's going to be a small one, we're talking like a half an inch or smaller, I use the dram vials and I put a layer of substrate on the bottom, maybe a half an inch, 3/4 of an inch of substrate, and obviously moist substrate. And then what I do is I put some sphagnum along the top. And sometimes what you'll find is if you put a layer, like say a half an inch of substrate, half an inch of sphagnum, they can't really lose themselves. What they will do is they will hang out and they'll do a little burrowing, but they'll also use that sphagnum at the top kind of as a hide and a burrow. And I've had ones that just web little tunnels in that, so you can always keep an eye on them. They're near the surface. It's not like they can get caught beneath an inch and a half, 2 inches of substrate. That sphagnum gives you a little buffer. It gives them a place to hide. It allows them to kind of feel like they're burrowing without giving them a situation where they could bury themselves to the point where they can't find prey. And I've been doing that a lot lately and having really good luck with it, especially with the teeny tiny ones. I have the Pseudohapalopus species Columbias. And those guys started off the smallest spiders I have ever raised in my life. I've raised quite a few slings over the years. I think I've admitted before that the really tiny ones still freak me out a bit. These were so small that when I would try to focus my eyes on them, and I actually have pretty decent vision. I do a lot of, you know, I used to draw, I do a lot of detail work. I can see pretty well. And my eyes would cross, like I'd get a headache trying to focus on these guys that were so tiny. So when I went to set them up, I had five-ounce deli cups set up, and I'm like, there's no way I'm putting them in these five-ounce deli cups. I will never see them. So I used little tiny, they're about, I think the diameter is probably an inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch or so, and they're about 2 inches deep, so small. I put about a half an inch of substrate, even less on the bottom, moist substrate, and then a lot of sphagnum moss. And they were able to hide in the sphagnum moss, so they felt like they were protected, but they didn't do a lot of burrowing, so they had to worry about where they were or them coming up to eat. So that's a little trick for some of the slings. But again, I don't. If you notice on my videos now, I used to always, you know, mentioned that one of the alternatives for slings was the 32-ounce deli cup for fossorial slings. I no longer mention those in that capacity. If I do, what I will say is if you have a larger sling, like an inch, inch and a half or so, then you could use a 32-ounce deli cup. Otherwise, use something smaller. I do think that it's just more prudent and easier to keep track of the spider when you have something that's going to burrow, that you give it something that it's not going to get lost in. Because what we are finding now, and it's weird because when I first got into the hobby, you didn't hear a lot of stories about them getting lost. And when somebody would make a comment like, yeah, bury it all. I remember reading one on arachnoboids where somebody's like, yeah, I put it in the 32-ounce deli cup. It went all the way down to the bottom and it's not eating. And somebody's like, well, they weren't around for a million years because they didn't know how to eat. They'll come up and eat when they want to. That's not always the case. And a part of that is due to the fact that we were putting them in closures that allowed, I think, a bit too much depth. So for those of you that have been in the hobby for a while, please chime in, because every time I do this, somebody chimes in with a good story about what, you know. And if you do chime in, talk about the species, specifically the species and the setup. Talk about how much substrate you had in there, because it seems like the common thread is they're deeper setups. We give them a lot of sub to dig in, which is great because they can go and tunnel and kind of have that natural behavior they would have in the wild where they would be able to tunnel. There's, you know, honestly, in the wild, there's nothing to stop them from tunneling as deep as deeply as they want. But I think mentioning exactly how deep it is kind of allows us to kind of get an idea of what's a good depth for them. What's, you know, this one was in, I had a 1-inch sling. It was in 5 inches of substrate and it buried down the bottom. It didn't come up. Then we know, all right, that's something we got to be careful of. I had a 1/2-inch sling. I put it in 2.5 inches of substrate. Let us know what the depth was, what species it was. Give us some detail and let us know what happened with it. I think one thing you got to be very, very careful with, and I said I would come to this point later on. When I did it with my P. muticus, I was fairly positive. When I opened up the burrow and dropped in the live one, I was about as positive as you can get that it was going to eat. I had already had it in my mind that this thing was ready to eat, that it just wasn't surfacing because it was too deep, and I expected it to go out and snatch the prey, so I dropped it in there. Had it not been eating, that could have been a disaster where I somehow had to try to get that cricket out of there because, God forbid, it had been premolt, although it was very thin. I didn't suspect it was in premolt. You do not want to drop live prey items into a burrow of a tarantula, especially one that you can't see. And that goes for, you know, whether it be crickets or roaches or mealworms or superworms, those can all bite. You want to make sure that you don't drop a live one down there. So I would encourage you a couple ways you can go about it if you feel like there's an issue. Again, if you find where you think the opening of the burrow is, very carefully open it. Soaking it down a little bit makes it so that you can kind of carefully pull hold the dirt out of the way and stick it to the side so it doesn't all crumble down in and cave in on you. I think that's important. Open up a little hole and pre-kill something and leave it up on the top. Leave it right on the hole, because what will happen is, and this is how you can tell, if you take the pre-killed item and leave it right over the top of that hole, right over the top of that entrance, the spider, if it isn't happy with you, if it isn't pleased that you just opened up its burrow, it will go back up there to fill up the burrow. If it's not eating, it will fill up the burrow and it won't bother with the prey item. However, what you will sometimes find is that it will come up and they will find the prey item and be like, oh, I'm hungry, and they will eat. And then you know it's a situation where it buried itself and wasn't coming back up. But again, I always hesitate to do this because I know what's going to have had people email me afterwards like, yeah, this wasn't eaten. So I opened it up and I threw a bunch of crickets in and now it's like all scared. Yep, because it was probably in pre-molt. So this isn't something, this is something that if you set them up correctly, you shouldn't have to deal with. If you don't give them, you know, I shouldn't say set them up correctly, but if you put them in enclosures or in setups that don't allow for them to be lost in the bottom. So keep those, you know, for the slings and for the fossorial species, keep those enclosures on the smaller side to start off so that you can make sure they can go up and find the prey items. And then it comes down to recognizing the behaviors of your spider. If you're keeping track of molts, it's usually pretty obvious to recognize when something is going to be in pre-molt and when it's a normal pre-molt behavior. And if you can, you know, look in there and see that it's molted and it still hasn't come up, then you might have a problem. But otherwise, you want to make sure that this isn't something where you're digging up all your tarantulas now because you're afraid they're not coming up to eat or whatever. It's recognizing the behaviors of your tarantulas, recognizing you may have a situation that may warrant it. So in other words, if you're looking at your little one inch mucus and you put it in a container that has 9 inches of substrate, yes, this might be a worry. If you're looking at your 1 inch P. mucus and you look over and it's got like 3 inches of substrate, probably not an issue. So it's recognizing that you have a setup that might warrant some worry over it. And then it's recognizing the behaviors of your spider, recognizing that, you know what, if your spider has been eating great and it disappears for a little while, that's probably pre-molt. If it disappears for a couple months, depending on the size, probably normal. If it's going to a point where you recognize it, normally my spider is out eating by now, something's wrong, you can trust your gut and try one of these, you know, the little experiment, open up the burrow carefully, leave a dead item there and see what happens. But again, it's one of those things that nobody talks about a lot. It's one of those things that I certainly didn't read much about the first several years I was in the hobby doing all my research, even after I've been keeping for a while. But I do think it is something that can happen on occasion. And it's something that is preventable if we just make sure that we don't overdo it with the substrate depth with our fossorial species or even just our slings that like to burrow. So hopefully that makes sense, everybody. These are the topics. I've done this a couple times now, and I usually get some great feedback, and then I usually get some people that go into panic mode, and I feel terribly about it. That's not what I'm here for. It's always about making things less stressful. But I think for some people I've encountered and talked to, they really appreciated that somebody else mentioned something that they had been seeing and thought they were crazy. Like, I've had people say, you know what, I heard your podcast, I opened up the burrow, it ate. I was thinking the same thing, but I thought that was wrong to do. So that would be my advice. Try to set them up in a way that doesn't allow for this to happen. If you think you're in a situation where it's occurring, take down some data. That's the other thing. Data is a big one. Sometimes you can look and go, all right, well, these guys actually did spend 2 months buried last time. Then you don't have to worry about it. If you have the data and can look back at it, that can help greatly. So there's something to be said by those of you out there that keep the journals. I've had people like, oh, I'm obsessive about writing down when they molt and how long they stay there. That's great. That helps. And I have to say, I'm not as good at that as I used to be. And then sometimes I'm left questioning, all right, when did that one molt? How long did it take last time? But keeping good data, keeping good setups, making sure you recognize the fact that it is a possibility that if you give them too much dirt, they can bury themselves and not come back up, can probably help you prevent this from happening. And again, if you have stories about it, feel free to chime in so other people can benefit from the knowledge, because I don't want it to be just, well, Tom's talking about spiders that buried themselves. I want to hear other people that have experienced the same thing. So that should do it for this one. As always, you can find me on tomsbigspiders.com, the website. You can find me on Tom's Big Spiders on YouTube. I just posted up, for those who like going over and checking them out, I just posted up a video featuring my Brachypelma classy, beautiful spider, the Mexican Pink Beauty. They're just ones that I honestly weren't on my radar until I got one. And I was raising up as a sling. I was like, oh, pretty cool sling, typical Brachy, whatever. And then it got its adult colors. It started to get its adult colors. And I'm like, holy crud, these guys are gorgeous. So if you want to bop over and see that one, maybe I'll do a podcast that next week, talk a bit about it. We're also going to be getting some guests on here coming up. Very excited about that. And that should do it for this one. As always, guys, stay safe, and we'll catch you all next time.